elephant in that is the oxidizer is nitro tetroxide, and then they have the hypogolic fuels. Not a cancerous, by the way, so you know, let me drop it. So it's very similar to what the SPECT has. And the same thing with the thrusters on board lawyers. Now, when they come up, like, they might send a progress ship up, you know, the Russians. They have, you know, when they dock to the center module, that's the last one in the back, there's connections that are made, and sometimes they have special fuel tanks that are launched from Russia that now that fuel gets pushed into storage on the International Space Station. So the space station itself has thrusters in the back that could help, you know, push these space station out of the way in case there's debris or, you know, satellite that might be in the way. So it's whatever, you know, there's no emergency vehicle that they can jump into. There was a proposal years ago called the XV-6, and they were going to attach that to the space station to handle up to 7 people. And that was going to be there, like, permanently. And in case there was a problem, they would have taken that back. But that whole program was canceled. Back to you, Roy, WS2S.
Okay, very good. Wesley, I hope that answers your question. By the way, I was kind of thumbing through good old Gilbert Lewis. Now, he got it pretty much all wrong. He was a physical chemist. He was not a physicist. And so his idea, he gave it a nice name, photon, that stuck. But his idea of a photon is a completely different thing. He considered it the smallest quantity of radiant energy, but he didn't think of it as energy and all kinds of weirdness. So although his name stuck to the photon, the underlying concept is pretty much all Albert Einstein's invention.
Okay, thank you very much for that. So the question to Paul, which I actually addressed to you before, but you weren't available, we have liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, or any kind of oxidant. It could be solid propellant that containing oxidizers. And question for you is how do they operate in space? What is the most of the technique commonly used right now and eventually for the escape capsules, if there are any application, how to damage oxidizers?
Okay, yeah, the oxidizers are nitric tetroxide, so that's what they use. You know, that's in one tank, and that when that's in the presence of this hypogolic fuel, I'm trying to think of that. It's a long name. I used to have it memorized. What the fuel was. I'll think of it later. But when those two mix together, they ignite. So they use them for their thrusters. They use them for let's say reentry too, or for more powerful thrusters. They have little thrusters around the, let's say there's around 60 on the Starliner that have these 100-pound thrusters, and then once you hear about them failing, they five of them failed on the way up the sign, but then they got four of them back working. They don't need them all because it's all built around redundancy, so there's no problem in getting them back home right now. And then you have the bigger thrusters, I think they're capable of actually 1,000 pounds per square inch each, and then, you know, so they're the ones that are used for an abort when, you know, going uphill. So similar type of setup for a crew vehicle as well. You know, you notice that all the launches don't have a launch escape system, like I have on Mercury. You didn't have it on Gemini, but you did have it on Apollo. You have it on the new Orion spacecraft that's going to the moon. You know, that's attached to the front of the vehicle, and they're all solid fuel rockets. I'm just the ones that pull the vehicle away. You know, they call that the tractor system that pulls the spacecraft away from the booster. Those are all solid fuel. So, you know, a mixture of usually aluminum with oxidizer mixed in. That's for solid fuel. But the other one, Boeing, Starliner, and Dragon, they have the pusher system for skid vehicles. So on the way up, they have to get away from the booster that they ignite in. And create this roughly around 120 to 160 step pounds thrust to get away from the booster, you know, in case it's exploding. That happened recently also with Blue Origin a couple of years ago, almost 2 years ago. They were sending up an unmanned suborbital vehicle. Normally they do man them, but this one was unmanned. And they had a problem with the booster. With B3 engine is liquid hydrogen, They had a problem with that. The nozzle overheated. They eventually had to redesign the nozzle. But because that was going to blow, the crew vehicle, in this case, no crew, and did that scientific experiments on it, separated from that booster using these similar, very powerful thrusters, but again, liquid, they were liquid fired with nitrogen. They all use these nitrogen tetroxide for the oxidizer. Anyway, back to US, WS1.
Thank you for mentioning aluminum powder, particular and fuel and ammonium perchloride as an oxidizer. My question is, Elon Musk and other companies, actually other countries, we have Chinese landing on the other side of the moon. So the story is that we potentially have ability to, whether we go to Mars or we go to the other side of the moon, where also it is water, actually ice. Right. So we have a choice to make our own fuel, but then what about oxidizers? Do you know about it?
They have a capability of breaking up the regolith and actually getting oxygen out of that material. Especially on Mars, they'll be able to do that as well. Even so, they have it for two on Mars. They can do it relatively easy, but there's also a process for actually mining the material itself on let's say, the moon and get the chemical process. But, by the time you're done, you could have hydrogen actually out of the solid material. That's one way, but the most popular way, of course, is to get that frozen ice out of, let's say, the moon. You'd, of course, melt that down, and now you got water, or you could get hydrogen and oxygen. And, that's perfect fuel. Look at the stable. The RS-25 engines that were attached to the space shuttle, not the solid boosters, but the three that were actually attached to the space shuttle. Liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen engines, they did quite well. And out of four of them attached to the SLS space launch system, RS-25 engines, the engines they used for shuttle. So that whole deal is liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. But on the moon, they need methane. So that is also some kind of process where they can get the methane out of the rocks, from what I understand. Chemical process. Well, because they're going to need to refuel that vehicle, the Starship vehicle. That'll be the first one that they use. Of course, I think this is 10 years down the road, you know, but, you know, the chemistry is there. I just don't think the money is. Back to you, Wes.
The dam's a little bit unclear to me, or even more complicated. So, taking the water, we have 11% condition of oxygen and almost 89% of the hydrogen. But then you're talking about the methane. Do they need water and methane together? That's how you're going to get oxygen. You have methane by itself.
Well, you can get the oxygen from the from the frozen water, you know, and that's how they would do it on the moon. On Mars, you could do the same thing, use the water, get the oxygen that way. Of course, they could take it right out of the air like they're doing now. They have the MOXIE program on Perseverance. Container, they put into operation. Taking the air, the carbon dioxide out of the air on Mars, and separating it, it's throwing away the hydrogen. Of course, in the future they would save that and use it as fuel, but throws that away as they decompose the air in that atmosphere. They throw away the carbon, and they just keep the oxygen. And that's been filling, fills up a tank, and which has been proven. So they said that they saved enough oxygen in that process to support a human being for a day or something, whatever it is. So all they need is to duplicate that, except need like something probably the size of a house where the vents produce oxygen on the moon. But they have this ability to get the methane out of rocks or something. But I read it somewhere where it was in my book, where they could actually separate the rocks when we drop it. You read a book called Mission to Mars, and it's pretty much a geology book. And one of the things they talk about is separating the material on Mars and getting methane out of that. And it also might be just, free methane on Mars, but that, the idea is to refuel the vehicles that will be landing there. And if Starship is one of them, that's methane and liquid oxygen. Back to you, Wes.
Liquid oxygen. We have a temperature variation on the moon, right? And the temperature has to be low in order to keep oxygen in liquid form. That is the part that's not clearly understood for me. How did he do it?
I missed that. Anyway, by the way, this book is Larry Crumpler, Crumpler. Excellent, excellent book. Tell you everything you want to know about Mars and a lot of the planets. But they mainly concentrate on it. I kind of missed that question, Wes. Go ahead.
I was talking about liquid oxidants. How do they keep liquid oxidants in the liquid form in the environment where temperature gradation is rapidly changing, like Moon or Mars? Back to you.
It's impossible.
They'll store it. Once they have it as a gas, you can do anything. You compress it. You take the heat away from it. And there's always heat and stuff, and you can always, lower the temperature in it. And eventually it would liquefy. Do that. Eventually you're going to wind up with a whole bunch of liquid oxygen. It's just a refrigeration process, like you do here on Earth. You get the pressures right and the temperatures right. Get cryogenic refrigeration systems, cascade systems, they call it. One condenser is, you know, is connected up to another or next to an evaporator, and you do that a couple of different times in a cascade. I mean, you can get to, you know, absolute zero if you wanted to. So, I mean, we do that on Earth. We can do it anywhere on the planet, anywhere in the universe. Back to you.
Where's all the energy coming from?
Okay, well, stand by. Roy, I'm going to pass it over to you. I didn't know I was going to be on this one. The question was, you better take it, Roy. WS2.
Yeah, I have two more. The three.
Yeah, fine. And whoever is kind of breaking in without IDing themselves, if you don't have a license, you're not supposed to be here. If you do have a license, you're supposed to tell us what your license is. But go ahead, Wesley.
Yes. So, it is questionable how in such a wide temperature variation in the moon, actually, what is the temperature variation from the other side of the moon? That's a good question. Paul, please.
Well, it's not like the dark side. Like I was a kid, I thought it's the dark side, you know, but it's the far side. So it lights up over there. So it could be hot, you know, 200 degrees, or it could be -200 degrees. So you have almost a 500 degree swing on the moon, or you know, anywhere base. I mean, if you're doing an EVA. One side of your spacesuit is going to be very hot. The other side of the other side is going to be very cold. Hundreds of, you know, degrees different. And if they have, you know, circulation systems with the spacesuit. You know, otherwise you would, you know, half your body would freeze. The other one, I guess, would melt. Anyway, it's roughly, I used to say 500, but it's more like 425 degrees or something different. From daytime Mars to nighttime Mars, 14-day swing, 14 Earth-day swing. Back to you, when?
Hey, John, the subject changed. GPS. I know you know it. Right. You know it too. But anyhow, easy. Are the GPS satellites, are geostationary or not, Dr. Ray?
It's a good question, but unfortunately, I don't know.
Hey, Paul, please.
Half the distance, was, let me drive it. Yeah, just like you, Jim. The satellites are 23,000 roughly miles off Earth. Geosynchronous is 11,000, roughly half the distance between Earth and the geosynchronous one. That's what all your constellations are for the GPS.
Okay, so let's start from the beginning. We have a satellite. How do we classify satellites, or how do we understand the term satellite, Paul?
To me, anything going around another body, the moon is a satellite of Earth, and, you know, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter 2009 is a satellite of the moon going around and around. Korean spacecraft doing the same thing that the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is doing. That's a satellite. And almost 6,000 satellites that Elon Musk put up there are all satellites of Earth, you know. I'm concerned we're a planet going around the sun, but if you want to call us a satellite going around the sun, I would go along with that. What?
Okay, so we have a natural satellite in our solar system, and then we have at least 24 artificial satellites used for GPS, and those are satellites that we put in orbit, and they are about 20 1,000 kilometers, which is about 13,000 miles away from us, equally spaced on the orbit. So my question was, are those GPS satellites geostationary? So they are at fixed orbit, at fixed point. So when the Earth moves, the satellite moves exactly at the same position to me at Earth, which is geostationary. The call, please.
Yeah, just because they're at 11,000 above the surface of the Earth, their speed is a lot faster than geosynchronous satellites going around the Earth. So, you know, you're going to have one orbit is 11 hours or something. I'd have to look it up again. At 11,000 miles above the Earth. The closer you go, the faster it takes around the Earth. You know, you look at the space station, and the Tiangong space station that China has. You know, these are all low-flying vehicles as far as those other satellites are concerned. A couple hundred miles, the space station is ISS is 250 miles above the Earth. So 90 minutes around and around and around. If you have a long orbit like the Chandra goes out to one third distance between here and the moon. That's the apogee, perigee, comes down to around, I think, 3,000 or 1,000 miles above the surface of the Earth. It takes, you know, many days before that makes one orbit, a couple of days. It's all relative to whatever height you're talking about. So they are always changing. They're not in the same location. Yeah, that was great. They probably thought of that. Let's put them in geosynchronous orbit, but then the signals would have had a hard time. You know, they would have needed more powerful transmitters. They would have needed bigger antennas for receiving signals from Earth. So they compromise and they have to distance. Back to you, Wes.
Okay, Dr. Murray. I think you already found it. So I was asking about geosynchronized real positioning of the GPS satellites. Is it true or false? And then I have a question related to that. Dr. Wright?
I don't understand, Wesley. Paul told you in two different ways that GPSs are not in synchronous orbit. They're not. They would have to be higher up, and in order to operate, you would need more sophisticated receiving equipment to receive the satellite signal. So they're not in geosynchronous orbit.
No, it's always for what he said, and now I hear what you said, which is true. So they have a complete two full orbits per day. But then, my question is, does the GPS satellite, because our position is found out by triangulation, so we have 3 or 4 or 5 satellites in the field of view, and we can read the data from it to find out our location. It's okay. And then our telephone is sending our geolocation, our location to the program, and that program, mapping program from the phone is able to guide us with where we're going. But the question is, how does the satellite that is not at a geosynchronic orbit is able to find its own location, or maybe different, how do we know where satellite exactly is? Because based on its position, we are able to eventually use the GPS program that is built into our phone with our GPS receiver. Dr. Roy.
It's tracking information. It knows what time it is. It knows what speed it's going. It knows what direction it was traveling in. All orbits are trackable. You know, they follow the the standard equations that go as far back as Newton's Principia. So it, although it's not synchronous over your specific area on the ground, the tracking information is very precise.
Okay, after the question, Cole, how do they track? What means do they use to track the satellite eventually? It's supposed to be some standard, some point of reference, so the satellite knows exactly what it is on the orbit. So based on its position, we can eventually use the satellite to position, to find the position of ourselves.
Those satellites, on top of that, they're in contact with each other. They're going around. You know? So, the initial, you're saying the initial time stamp that they started, you know, probably, you know, dozens of, tens of dozens of years. How long have we had GPS satellites up there? From that time frame, you know, they know exactly where they are. They know if they're getting higher or lower in orbit. You know, if their orbit's changing. Due to a rarefied gas that might be slightly pointing down, although at that orbit, it's pretty much not going to happen. The GPS satellites also take into consideration two other factors. The Doppler effect, you know, as it's coming toward you, your phone's able to compensate for that. Based on the frequency, it's also able to compensate relativity. You know, at that height, time ticks by at a different time than down here. So, you know, you might be a split second off compared to down here. Then compensate that, your car might be telling you to make a right turn here, meanwhile you're supposed to be going another two or three blocks. You're not going to find your way to the gas station. Back to the west.
That I know. So maybe I can rephrase it a little bit. There are 260 degrees in complete circle and 60 minutes in 1 degree. So the minutes are usually displayed as a decimal number, and both latitude and longitude are angles, and they therefore they have to be measured in reference to a well-defined zero line. What is zero line? What is actually that the GPS satellite by itself is using as point of reference to eventually send the right information down?
Okay, that's called the ascending node and descending node. As it goes around the Earth, it passes a certain point. Most of the time they use the equator as the location. That's the ascending node and the descending node. And tracking programs show that. That information. And that information, whenever it crosses that certain point, you know, that's, and then descending node, they want to cross that point. They know exactly, computers know exactly, you know, how best they're going and all that. So they base it on that, as far as I know. Back to you.
And the same to Dr. Roy, and the additional question is, because I don't know that, absolutely I don't know that, is the orbit of a positioning satellite able to be corrected? Back to you, Dr. Roy.
You know, they have thrusters and stuff on board. You know, they can move these things if they have to, you know that, right, Wes?
Yeah, that is actually coming to them from my question about oxygen. They have to have a means, because they are so long in space, they have to have a means to correct that orbit, if it's needed to be to correct it. Maybe Dr. Roy has some more information. Dr. Roy?
Yeah, by the way, my All-Star failed, so I had to reboot it. The primary method that GPS satellites use to determine their own location is not done internally. it's done through tracking stations on the ground. They use Dopplers, they use lasers, they use radar. So it's all done through ground stations covering the entire Earth, tracking all of the GPS satellites.
And maybe you found something about the correcting of an orbit of the satellite.
Nothing specific, but since they're always tracked by ground stations, any kind of perturbation is detected and corrected for.
Oh, so should I understand that no action of the elliptical pattern of that satellite movement is needed? It is just reading its actual position and applying the error, the correction into it from the base station, from the ground station, correct?
Again, that is my understanding from what I've been reading. It appears that all the location data is based on ground stations. There's no calculation internal as far as the orbit. They do make corrections, as I think Paul mentioned earlier, about relativistic time. The flow of time is different on the surface of the Earth versus the satellites. So that correction is typically done internal to the satellite. But as far as orbital information, it's all gained through stations, not through the electronics in the GPS units.
Okay, Paul. Do you have any addition to that?
No, that sounds good to me. But they don't last forever, by the way. You know, they have had a couple, and other countries are putting up GPS as well. Galileo project by European space agency. They have an initial one or two up, but they're going to put it up a few dozen as well, very soon. In fact, they have the rocket that's going to first launch next month, the Ariane 6 rocket taking over from the Ariane 5. They'll be putting up the Galilean GPS satellites for Europe. China has one going as well. Good questions, Wes, but I don't have anything else to add. Back to you.
Okay, I quickly typed who sponsors Galileo GPS satellites, but I'm not sure if I got the right answer. It says, in 2023, Galileo continues to provide world's most precise satellite navigation information to more than 4 billion users. EUSPA, ESA, but nothing more than that. Who sponsors Galileo? Back to you.
Well, it's ESA, European Space Agency, is involved with that. And there's going to be cross connections to our GPS system. Refine locations. That's going to help. You never know, a couple of these things could quit. And it's nice to have friends on the other side of the globe. Back to you, Wes.
Okay, I just found. So, January 21, 2021, European Commission announced in January 20th of that year, it will alert contact to Airbus to build a set of next generation Galileo navigation satellites. So it looks like Europe will become pretty much independent from American GPS system. Dr. Ray.
Okay, I mean, that's a reasonable thing. We have the option to turn off the high precision content encrypted so that only our friends get it. So if we ever get into a nasty fight, all of a sudden your location becomes less accurate. The Russians are working on their own GPS systems for the same reason, and probably China will as well. So, and earlier you mentioned some number of satellites. You got to remember to add all those damn Starlink satellites in the sky.
Yeah, that's a good point. I believe Starlink is coordinated by our GPS system because they have to know where to go. And they are temporary, and they are not forever. They are lower orbit. I wonder what to can say about that system. But it looks like Galileo is gonna be superior. As far as the Russian GLONASS system, it's a piece of junk. The Russian uses American GPS system to guide their rockets. Anyhow, call please.
Yeah, I wouldn't trust the Russians. Right now, it's not a good thing to do that. But the European Space Agency, like I said, they're going to be arranged, you know, coordinated with the American GPS over time. No, they're not up and running yet. They got to wait for that Ariane 6 to start delivering a number of satellites up there for them. And we'll be able to see theirs and vice versa. We won't know. It'll be just automatic in our equipment. As you travel along, you won't know whether or not you're using a Galileo satellite or an Orbit satellite. And neither will the Europeans. It should be, I think it's going to be much better to have that. Yeah, there was a question that you had on, I don't remember. Right?
Comment. Yes, John?
If you want to pick up the rest of the question first, that's fine too, but I have a question.
Well, you're free to ask questions. It's Wesley Mike right now. Perhaps he's winding down.
Yes, I am. So thank you very much to Roy, and thank you very much, Paul, for your help and your professional and very much helpful information. I have nothing more. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Wesley. And on to KC2SO, John.
Yeah, good evening, Roy and everyone else. Question related to what you guys are talking about. By the way, sorry, it's an M90 here. What I remember from my time learning about GPS many, many years ago was that before they had turned off the higher. Let me rephrase that. Before they made the high precision mode available to everyone, that there were ground stations transmitting correction data, and basically that if you were within range of these ground stations, that you could almost get the same kind of precision. One, does any of that still exist? Two, are our current GPS receivers equipped to deal with that if they did go back to the less precise method? Is the question clear?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding of how GPS began was it was a DARPA thing, and the military had the precise signals, civilian foreigners had the far less accurate, and at one point or another they decided for the betterment of mankind, they turned off the lock for the precise time code. I would assume that there's no feature to get around that developed over time if everyone's just expecting to get a high precision time signal. And if they turn the encryption back on, then the military will be the only people who expect have access to it. You might be able to find some leaked signals near the base stations. I don't know. But, I mean, fundamentally, I would think that no one would approve circuitry for the GPS to get around the limitations that were hardwired into way back at the beginning.
On know, quite the opposite. It used to exist. That was the way many people got around the averaging issue, was that the other stations were already doing the averaging and determining some correction factors and broadcasting it on some additional frequencies, so you could receive that and get faster precision with the non-precise system. Such as the tech when we were doing TIN system that I studied a little bit when I was younger. Never got into that career, but I studied a little bit.
Okay, I mean, there'll always be a kludge, but I don't think the kludge is built in to the GPS systems that are designed these days. You'd have to add the similar kludge. You could always add more information if you have reference data. But the GPS unit itself is going to be as imprecise as it was before they turned that precision on.
Yeah, and maybe it's true for all, you know, typical consumer devices, but this was built into the Garmin at the time. We bought a Garmin and had that feature. It was built in.
Oh, okay. I was unaware of that. But you still have to depend upon third party giving you a reference signal. Was that a freebie? Was that a lease or a contract? Or who provided it and under what circumstances? Because I realize there are some very generous people out there. Most of the time, people want to be paid for their business.
Yeah, I don't remember all the details about to who, where, and why. I just remember that it existed. It was part of the system, or maybe it was like a plug-in or something, you know. But the systems that they were selling for some of these GI coordinates had it built in. My understanding was it was more just kind of maybe ad hoc, volunteer level. I could be wrong. You know, it was years ago.
I mean, ultimately, if you put any security feature out there, people have it and they need to break it and break through it and crack it. And, you know, as people, you know, really DVD and Blu-ray encryption codes being broken and copy protection encryption broken, you know, it's like any locksmith says, you know, locks will not prevent entry. They just slow things down and provide more work for the person than the building next door. So I have no doubt that people can break through GPS systems as well as pretty much anything else, because there's always going to be hardware that has the encryption coding, and people will get it some way, at least for a short period of time, where they can dump the code and reverse engineer things. So theoretically, it's encryptable, and I don't think that GPS units themselves are designed these days with kind of add-ons that do auto-correction in case the precision has changed, but there's probably either third-party devices or guys who have the schematics for third-party devices ready to roll in case that becomes a viable option for people.
Yeah, real good question, especially with the wings are these days. Even if it wasn't ready and waiting, it wouldn't take long to come up with similar solutions. Could probably be deployed and added a lot faster than 30 years ago, that's for sure. Anyway, that was just my thought when you guys were talking about GPS. I was wondering if that still existed, if anybody was still maintaining that, if anybody was, I guess, my guess would be it just went away. You know, there's one more need for it. It would probably just disappear into the ether. Anyway, making dinner for the family here. I'm Joey Menekes, KC2GF, KC2SHO. Thanks for coming.
Okay, very good. I appreciate your participation as always. Have a great dinner. Be well and enjoy Father's Day. Nowadays, getting something from schematic to working device is ridiculously fast. You know, I mean, I've seen YouTubes where guys just send off electronic files to manufacturers in China, and a week or two later, they have a bunch of soldered circuit boards. So the turnover rate can be incredibly short these days. So, and again, people are always breaking into things. I think there's no impetus as far as GPS is these days, because the high precision signals been transmitted for so many decades that a lot of youngsters don't even remember when that was a problem. So my guess would be there's no real hardware right now. But again, if anything were to change, you probably would need a stopwatch to measure the time between when they're in encryption on and someone pops up with a circuit board cable defeating it. Okay, I had a little bit of problem with All-Star tonight for some strange reason. Seems to be a little bit hickety. Anyway, this is AC2GS with the Linemark Technical Net. We still have about 15 minutes if anyone cares to use them. So if you have any questions or comments or topics for discussion, please feel free to hit that push to talk. Okay, whoever that was, you were about 99% noise and 1% audio. So see if you can change that around a little bit, if you can raise your power out. Otherwise, if you could reorient your antenna, whatever it takes to get it to the repeater. Okay, nothing much heard. Hopefully that guy is maybe climbing up a hill right in front of his house. Maybe a little elevation will help. Nevertheless, I continue the AC2GS. This continues to be the Linemark Technical Net. And as I said, we've got a little bit of time to kill if you're so inclined. If anyone out there has any questions or comments or topics for discussion tonight, we still got some time, so hit the push to talk.
WS2N. I don't know if you recall old GLONASS system. Not the GLONASS system, that was LORAN system. LORAN system that was the history started from Second World War, actually before that, and triangulation was used, but only during World War II, German stations were triangulating the partisan stations using antennas and tracks, and then after World War II, there was LORAN system. It was before GPS came to reality. Do you recall that system?
Yeah, I think I talked about it a year or so ago, that there are the pseudo-LORAN systems that are kind of used here and there type of thing, but as a large system, it kind of faded, certainly after GPS. Paul, I think, wanted to say something. So, Paul, what do you want to say?
I'm just saying this is the last night before field day. So yeah, I thought maybe you wanted to talk about that for a little bit, but you know, that's coming up Saturday and Sunday. It starts at 2 o'clock on Saturday. It goes for 24 hours. So that's always a lot of fun. And then now they have, Linemark has the new location, South Nassau. I forgot the name of, the name of the park. From what I understand, it's much better than the previous location that they had. You know, it sounds like they were happy with it. I'll try to make it over there on that Saturday. And it starts at 2. So. Always fun, you know, you're getting of it, you know. The bands are quiet, and all of a sudden, you know, the clock strikes 2, and, you know, you hear all kinds of, you know, voices coming through the radios. A lot of fun. I guess we can talk about the results of it to some extent Sunday. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Yeah, that's it. I have two clubs. So my Brooklyn-based club, Kings County Radio Club, is having their field day in Floyd Bennett Field. They've been doing it in Floyd Bennett Field for decades. Unfortunately, the immigrants have pitched housing areas in Floyd Bennett Field, so we thought that we weren't going to be able to use the place at all, but they were able to offer us a parking lot in a different location still within Floyd Bennett Field. So the Sky Radio Club will have their field day in Floyd Bennett Field, and Linemark will have it, Paul just mentioned. And if you guys have got nothing better to do Sunday morning from about 11 o'clock to 12:30 or so, and you want to make a pact on tenders, come by 28.381. I'll be there with my own little station on my 10-meter net that I do every Sunday morning. So nice of you, good of you to mention it, Paul. If anyone else has any Field Day-related comments and they'd like to share them, please do.
And one more comment.
Certainly.
Last Thursday, Ken, WB2, KWC did a nice presentation on Field Day, you know, the computers and everything that they use, that they hook up to all these radios. Very good. I know they recorded it, so maybe by now they have it on the Linemark YouTube channel. I don't know. But they did a good job with that. So it looks good. Linemark is going to be 6A, 6 Alpha. NLI, of course, for New York, Long Island. So that means they have six radio stations. They have a governor station and digital. I don't understand, it's a CW station. So there you go. And from what I understand, the weather's supposed to be good. Maybe a little on the hot side, but, you know, no storms or anything from what I heard. Back to you, Brian.
Okay, very good. Glad to hear. This is AC2GS, by the way. Yeah, hopefully it'll be interesting. Again, guys out there, passing by 10 meters, go to 28.380, 381, say hello. And we'll see what Field Day brings us next Sunday, Saturday and Sunday. Yeah. Very good. Once again, I'm AC2GS. Anyone else with any comments? Okay, nothing going on there. Again, AC2GS with the Linemark Technical Net. We have a few more minutes. If anyone has something that they'd like to talk about, or a question they'd like to ask, or a comment they'd like to make, please do. Well, I guess everyone's talked out, and it's coming close to the end of the segment anyway, so I'll give you guys a Father's Day break. What say we bring on Paul, WS2Ed, with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, I know the carrier doesn't seem to drop. I hear the tone, but I don't know. It seems to be working fine. We'll go with that. Starliner, we talked about that a little bit before. That's the vehicle that was built by Boeing that successfully launched to the space station on the 5th. Of June and docked to the space station the next day on the 6th. Little problems. They had problems with their thrusters. Like I said, there's around 60 thrusters surrounding the service module and the spacecraft itself. And out of 50 some odd, they had problems with 5. They eventually got 4 of them back working. It's a software problem. They set these limit switches. I'm sure they're very careful with them. They don't want to, you know, exceed, but they realize that software sometimes that they do too sensitive, and then, you know, when it's something that just goes a little out of, away from where it's supposed to be on their reading, the software shuts it down. So apparently they're correcting that now. They were supposed to come back on the 18th. Now it's due to launch on the 22nd, which of course is Field Day. So next Saturday they're scheduled to fly back to New Mexico in the White Mountains, well, you know, middle of nowhere, southern New Mexico area. Same area where they used to first land the shuttle. The shuttle first landed. They landed White Sands. They set up a runway there, and it's probably still there. They used it as in case it was an emergency, it'd still be able to land there. But time went by, they eventually landed in California and flew the shuttle back on top of the 747 all the way to Florida. Of course, they used to launch from Florida on a regular basis and land in Florida with their 3-mile runway that's used. You know, they'll come back through the atmosphere First on dock, same day, it'll be Sonny Williams and the commander, Butch Wilmore. They'll come, deorbiting thrusters, slow themselves down a little bit, and eventually they'll start picking up rarefied air, slow them down even more, pick up a real high speed, where the heat shield comes into play, creates a plasma surrounding the vehicle, and just like the, you know, the other jizz that they'll lose, creatures that they can be atmosphere, there's some plasma built around it. If they come through, but eventually they'll dissipate. They'll get down to the, I believe it's just suborbital, Mach 1 speed. The two parachutes come out and pull out three big main parachutes, and that should slow them even more. And then as they're coming down closer to the ground, the heat shield will separate from the vehicle, exposing the airbags. They'll inflate just the last second before they hit the ground in New Mexico. Anyway, that's the plan for Starliner. Yeah, that goes forward to that'll be the first landing on land for a space capsule for the United States. You know, all our vehicles have landed in the water, in the ocean. SpaceX lands in the ocean or Gulf of Mexico. That's the story with that. I put a picture on Dr. Moore's website, picture of the space station. The reason I thought it was interesting is because they have the Starliner attached to it. You get a good idea of the reference, if you know anything about the size of the Starliner. It's only a little tiny triangle in the picture, and compared to the massive International Space Station that's really up there. It's a unique picture because it's a real photograph taken from a Maxar commercial satellite flying above the space station. The satellite was 300 and some odd miles up, but you know they timed it. They took a picture of it of that. From looking at it above the space station. And I did try to send, what I did with that picture, not sure I got it from the internet, I tried to put the word Starliner on it and then an arrow pointing to it, and it worked on my computer, on the Google Docs. In fact, I'm looking at it now. Then I tried to send that picture to you, Roy, on an email, and all the text was coming out, but the picture would not go on email, which is strange. I wonder if you've ever come across that. Now, what I did, I went back to the original picture before I doctored it, before I put the word Starliner on it, copied that, and no problem, it went on to an email. So that's why I sent to you. But if you ever came across that, is there a problem with sometimes when you change a picture, add words, is there a copyright on these pictures where you can't do anything with them? I wonder if you know anything about that. Or is it just Google Docs or maybe a glitch in my system? Back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS2M.
Yeah, AC2GS. It shouldn't be copyright. It's probably that it's just not saving that layer, so it's sending the same thing. So the problem is how different programs handle different graphics. Sometimes they just put it into one layer and it's fine. Other times they generate a new layer for each additional element and they don't particularly save them well. So it just sends the base layer instead of all the other ones. That's possibly what we're on.
I've sent you pictures and I've put words on there, I put arrows on, in the past, it's gone over, but this one didn't want to do it, and I'm thinking because it's a Maxar picture, it's a commercial company, they've got, a bunch of satellites up there now, and I don't know who launches them, I don't know if it was SpaceX, or I think another company called Planet. Same thing, they have commercial pictures. And I know Rocket Lab is also launching these things too. And they're small. They're not big satellites, but they have really good cameras on them. And the idea is to take pictures of the Earth.